So here is another kind of substitute show, which I'll be recording kind of on the fly or in motion, or actually I'm not too much in motion, but I'm at a distant spot from where I usually do these shows because I was evacuated from Felton, and we're just now learning. Today is the 29th of August. We can get back into Felton, but I've got to set up the computer again. And so what I'm doing is I'm going to try to turn out a kind of an on-the-move series of interviews, which hopefully will give you a little taste of some of the experiences that people are having outside, some of the voices from the street, and as well as my own thoughts on what little bits I can pick up. So this is kind of this is a show that kind of attempts to make up for the Thursday missing show from yesterday, August 28th, and there's going to be a couple of missing shows, I imagine, because I'm going to necessarily fall behind, but we'll continue anyway, and here we go.
Songs of Star and of June songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm particularly concerned with the lack of police accountability, the militarization of the Santa Cruz police, the attacks that police routinely engage in almost as a ongoing normal, a horrific normal against homeless folks outside, in terms of criminalizing them for sleeping, setting up a tent, being in a park after dark, engaging in survival behavior and treating them like, less than human beings. This, I think, is the bigotry of the community and the tendency of the community to treat homeless people as subhumans, perhaps frightened that they may find themselves in that situation. Another part of it is the fact that police themselves are an institution unto themselves without any kind of accountability, really, whose crimes, when they are engaged in excessive force or even murder, which happens at an unusually excessive rate in the United States as compared with other countries, there's no, not even justice, there's no even real inquiry made into those deaths, and you have police officers investigating, quote-unquote, themselves, and so forth. There recently was, of course, the case of Jacob Blake, shot 7 times in the back in Wisconsin, and that produced protests and demonstrations, not enough protests and demonstrations for my money, and none in Santa Cruz that I'm aware of, although I'm kind of isolated and have not been really in touch with. Well, maybe there have been protests. If they have, please do contact me at 423-4833. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Or if there are any upcoming protests, which would be following in what has been, at least to some extent, an encouraged response to the national attack on police violence across the country, in the killing of George Floyd, some response to that. I think that kind of direct action protest, which involves such things as the removal of the fences at the post office, which were prohibiting homeless people from sleeping there, direct pressure on a city council which has no interest or intention to defund the police budget, although that has become a national cry across the country and across the city in Santa Cruz, at least to judge by the size and intensity of the early protests in late May and early June. So I saw on the Real News Network today a show which it's far more graphic if you actually see the video, but I think the audio has sufficient impact and is particularly instructive. So I'm going to play that now. It talks about how the attempts to get sort of piecemeal police reform, you know, put video cameras onto police squad cars or onto officers, ask for de-escalation tactics to be used, set up a police review board, all these things which have been proposed, and let's say as distinguished from defunding and completely abolishing police departments and restructuring things from the ground up again so that there's really a community response to the needs for safety in the community and to need to deal with the issues that police have been given guns, tasers, batons, and armored cars to deal with, which really sort of invites excessive force. Tough measures that have been proposed, and you see some of them being still proposed by people like Steve Plaich, who proposes a partial reduction in the police budget of 30%. I think that was his proposal recently on Santa Cruz Indie Media. Instead of a meaningful reduction that would actually vastly shift what police say is already too much of their time and energy. Even our local police department claims they don't want to be engaging in mental health operations or homeless control operations. But then, of course, they press for laws that expand their power and expand their use of such operations, or certainly don't contract it. And when courts come in and say, as in the Martin versus Boise case, you can't do it, then they respond with alternate kinds of citations. Illegal lodging, being in a park after dark, blocking the sidewalk, disobeying an executive order by Martin Bernal, which are now, of course, being rubber-stamped regularly by a city council that has no real public accountability anymore, since people can't attend their meetings, unlike the Board of Supervisors, where you still, as far as I know, you still could go. I don't know how that was last Tuesday, but in, I believe in August, you could go to the Board of Supervisors meeting. People did go. A group of people were protesting the use of masks, which I know some of my listeners would find would be a counterproductive kind of protest. Some would call it a pro-Trump protest, but I don't think that's really what the local Santa Cruzans who are against mandatory mask use under all circumstances or fines for masks not being used are actually all about. They're concerned with the use of government agencies acquiring power through this situation, police acquiring more power, and it has health is just sort of an incidental hook on which this gets hung as a kind of it's just one more ratcheting up of the police state to them. But the point is that the city council itself is not accountable for this stuff in ways that I don't think the Board of Supervisors is either. But still, at least the Board of Supervisors still has public meetings. The city council does not. So here's this police accountability report, the audio of it from a Baltimore station, video station that regularly puts out accounts. Every day they have a different story on a different issue. But there's a lot of focus on police abuse. And this is what we're going to be looking at here, or listening to, actually. And you can go look at it on the Real News Network as well. This episode is Jacob Blake's Family Will Have to Fight for Justice. Blake was the guy who was gunned down by the police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, earlier this week.
Hello?
Hello, my name is Teo Graham, and welcome to the Police Accountability Report. Now, normally at this point in the show, I talk about, of course, police accountability, but I'm going to have to change it up a bit here and say simply that the entire premise may be faulty. Why do I say that? Well, earlier this week, this scene played out in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Police shot Jacob Blake multiple times in the back while his children watched. The Kenosha, Wisconsin Police Department issued this terse statement until this video surfaced showing what led up to the shooting. Let's watch, but just a warning, what you are about to see is violent and very disturbing.
And of course, you can't see it because you're listening to this on the net, but you can go to the website and check that out. And probably you've already seen it if you follow this issue. It's the a citizen or a community member or just a passerby videoing this murderous attack on an unarmed man who they claimed later that there was a knife in his car on the driver's side on the floor, but there's no indication he was threatening the officer, and he was shot in the back. So let's hear more.
Blake survived the 7 shots and is paralyzed from the waist down. Protests have enveloped the town of Kenosha, and calls for the arrest of the officer involved have prompted protests throughout the city. Right-wing militias have also arrived, claiming to protect property. They killed 2 protesters and injured 1 early Wednesday morning. For more, I'm going to my reporting partner, Stephen Janis, out in the field. Stephen, please give us the latest of what is happening on the ground in Kenosha.
Well, in the third day of protests after the shooting of Jacob Blake, they have a militia, which has appeared, called the Kenosha Militia, which appears to be people from outside the area who came armed with guns to confront protesters. And what happened was one of those members of the militia shot and killed 2 people and severely wounded another during the protest. Some of this was captured on video, which we're showing right now. So it really seems to have escalated and turned what were peaceful protests into a violent confrontation.
Stephen, we have just found out that 2 protesters were just shot and killed, and 1 was wounded in Wisconsin. What is happening on the ground there?
Right now, we know who one person is, and that is 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse. He was arrested just today and charged with first-degree intentional homicide. So he is 17 years old. He is part of this militia. We don't have any sort of formal organization, but we do know that the sort of conspiracy theory-based website InfoWars was promoting the militia and promoting the fact that protesters should show up. So certainly it's part of a right-wing sort of perspective on this, and certainly fueled by right-wing extremism.
And what are police saying about the investigation into Jacob Blake's shooting?
Well, right now they are saying nothing. Technically, this investigation is being handled by the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Police have not talked about anything about the details, about why the officer did this. Another video emerged, which shows a couple minutes, seconds before the police are seen coming around the van from a different perspective, but it really doesn't tell us much, and police have said even little. One thing that's interesting is that the sheriff of the county that includes Kenosha said that he got a call from a person who said, "Why don't you deputize the entire city or deputize anyone who wants to bring guns?" And let's remember that the suspect in the murder had an AR-15 in his possession. So certainly we don't know much about the investigation, but we know tensions are heightened and we know that there is concern about violence there.
But the reason I said at the top of the show that my intro would be different is because the police shooting of Jacob Blake happened in the wake of a multi-year effort to reform the police in the same town where it happened. Since 2004, the father of Michael Bell Jr., who was shot by the same police department, has worked tirelessly to overhaul the process of investigating police shootings and called for reform of how police can use deadly force. Bell was shot during a routine car stop. Officers have pulled him over in his family's driveway for reasons that still remain unclear. And as he was being held over the car, an officer yelled that Michael had tried to grab one of the officer's guns, which was later proved to be untrue. But in the confusion, an officer shot Bell in the head. Turns out the gun accusations were false. No DNA or fingerprints were found on the officer's gun. There was no forensic evidence that Bell had touched the gun. Instead, an investigation afterward determined that the officer's weapon had brushed against a car side mirror. 3 days after the shooting, police cleared all the officers involved and no charges were filed. But Bell's father sued the department and won a settlement, which he used to fight to change the system. And he managed to win some changes to how police investigate themselves, which we will discuss later. But the bottom line is, despite the calls for change, Kenosha police are again involved in another controversial shooting. Even though the shooting of Bell led to reform and calls for changes to policing, the community again faces another troublesome use of force. To discuss what happened and why reforming law enforcement is always a work in progress, I'm joined by the man responsible for most of what little change has been seen in Kenosha. His name is Michael Bell Sr., and he is the father of the victim of the 2004 shooting. Here he is to talk about his efforts to obtain justice in the wake of his son's death and give us his take on the shooting of Jacob Blake. Mr. Bell, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm really happy to be here, and I hope I can help in some way.
So I know this is painful and must bring up terrible memories, but what did you think when you saw the video of the shooting of Jacob Blake?
It was pretty upsetting. I mean, it was very heartbreaking. You got to remember that I had my own son that was shot and killed by a police officer, and his mother and his sister stood there and watched it. And one of the first things that I saw was this young lady jumping up and down as her family member was being shot. And I knew the incredible amount of stress she was going through at that moment. So it's pretty emotional, pretty nerve-wracking.
So I want to talk about your struggle to reform policing in Wisconsin in light of your son's death. First, just so people understand, please tell us what happened to your son.
Well, first off, I'll give you the short answer, but if anybody wants to follow up on it, all they have to do is go to michaelbell.info, and they can watch a short documentary there. It's called Forensically Impossible, The Anatomy of a Police Cover-Up. And my son was coming home from a night out with friends. He arrived in front of his own home. He was turning off his car. A police officer arrived behind him. As he got out of the car, police officer yelled, "Get back in a car, get back in a car." There was no common courtesies. Not like, "Sir, can I see your driver's license?" The guy grabbed him by the neck, started pushing him in front of the car, and saw somebody else in the front seat and decided they didn't want two people together and pulled him in the back. Make a long story short, he made some accusations. He accused my son of speeding and running a stop sign. Later in depositions, he recanted that. But he inflamed the situation. He started accusing my sons of things that he didn't do. At some point, there was some arguing back and forth. They threatened to tase him. They did tase him. You can hear him screaming in the background in those videos. And essentially, he ran to the back of his own home, and the motion sensor spotlights turned on. A mother and sister came out and watched this, and they saw a Rodney King style beating occurring with my son. An officer bent Michael over the car hood in a bear hug. Another officer at that point screamed, "He has my gun." A fourth officer came up to the scene, put his gun directly to my son's temple, and pulled the trigger. The gun didn't fire because the slide on the gun was disengaged, and so the guy put the gun back to my son's temple and killed him right in front of his mother and sister. There were five civilian eyewitnesses, and not one of their testimony was even considered. They just strictly went to the version of the police officer. And later on in court, after years of waiting, my attorney allowed all four officers to lie in sequence. And after the last officer lied, he gave them a copy of the medical examiner's report. They created a story where they shot Michael on the left side of the head, and the medical examiner said that it was forensically impossible because he was shot on the right side of the head. And that led into a civil rights lawsuit. And what bothered me is, I'm a retired Air Force officer, I was a pilot. And what bothered me was that the co-workers of the officers involved conducted their own investigation and cleared the officers involved of no wrongdoing within 2 days. Two calendar days, they were complete. And I knew as an Air Force officer that accident investigations on airplanes took far longer, and I couldn't imagine even in the best scenario that something could be done in 2 days. And so we pushed for a law, and in 2014 we were able to get a law passed in the state of Wisconsin. I am told that it was the first in the nation, and that law states that no department that has a police-involved death can investigate itself.
Tell us what happened after your son was killed by the police. I believe the police investigation into his death took only 3 days, and it was ruled a justified homicide. Were there any criminal charges filed against these officers?
No. I still can't get the investigation open. It was a flawed original investigation. It was a cover-up. What we later found out was this. I brought in my own detectives. I brought in my own investigators. And actually, a police detective, his name is Russell Beckman, that worked for the Kenosha Police Department, he solved it. And what it was is that there was a gun belt on this one officer's holster, and it had what was called a jacket gap. And it fit perfectly onto a car mirror on this Nissan Pulsar where the struggle took place. And it fit right between the guy's gun and his belt, and as he turned, he felt a tugging on it, and that's why he screamed, "He has my gun." This officer committed suicide in 2010.
So you're essentially saying that police colluded and covered up a crime because they could not admit that they made a mistake?
There's a video online at michaelbell.info on our Facebook page, Plea for a Change. And it clearly, and we show how the chief of police and the DA and the sheriff colluded together to block a proper investigation. We showed how the officers changed their testimony. Up to 20 times they changed their testimony, and they allowed the changing testimony to fly. Nobody bothered to do anything about it. I have a letter from the Attorney General that says, at best, the officers were mistaken. At worst, they lied. And we still could not get any kind of investigation regarding this.
Mr. Bell, what was it like fighting the system? How hard was it to win the changes you fought for, and what were you able to accomplish?
Well, first off, it was a team effort. There were other people involved, and you have to remember that we settled a civil rights lawsuit, but I refused to accept a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement. We were able to bring the material forward. Instead of it being sealed and locked up, we were able to show the public really what's going on in Kenosha. But it was extremely difficult, and it was one of the most nerve-wracking things that we've done, but we got it done. And right now, the Jacob Blake case is being reviewed underneath that law. I mean, Kenosha police conducted the shooting, and an outside agency had to come in and conduct the investigation. But we still have problems, and we still have ways to go. And because the local DA, who is his political base is law enforcement in the community, both the sheriff's agency and their family and the police department, he gets to review the case. And so he's not going to go against his political base. So I can't speculate, but past history shows that he's probably going to disregard this and just favor the officer.
So, Mr. Bell, what do you want to see happen in the Jacob Blake case, and what do you want for your son's case? What do you think needs to happen in both cases?
Jacob Blake, officer needs to be an open and transparent investigation. The findings need to be released. I believe there should be an independent prosecutor appointed. I don't think somebody that works hand-in-hand with the chief of police. They're on a first-name basis. I have text messages between the DA and the chief of police, and they're on a first-name basis. I don't think he should be reviewing this case. And so I think there needs to be an independent outside prosecutor taking a look at it. And that's the best I can hope for now. I heard that Jacob Blake is paralyzed. I'm hoping that he recovers. I consider them to be lucky because at least he is alive, where I didn't have that. In my own son's case, I think there should be a grand jury, and I think that the findings will probably find that the officer should be charged with second-degree intentional homicide, and that's what I think needs to happen.
As you see the police reform movement in this country, what changes would you like to see made now that there's more awareness? What do you hope to see change?
First off, I support law enforcement. It's a very difficult job. And if you had a son or a father that was a law enforcement officer, you'd be very worried about that. And if you go to our Facebook page, I post heroic things that officers do all the time. And some of them, they're pulling people out of burning cars. They're rescuing people out of raging rivers. They're giving mouth-to-mouth to little babies that are suffocating. And so don't forget that. They're human beings, too. Right now, a bill is going to be introduced tomorrow in the state of Wisconsin, and it's a bill that creates an NTSB-style learning model for law enforcement. They're going to take a look at the shooting, and they're going to determine what went wrong, and they're going to look at root cause analysis, and they're going to try to figure out what makes it better. And just like in aviation, when an airplane crashes, they look at all the root cause analysis, and they try to figure out how to stop it from happening again. But not only do you have to do that, then you have to teach those lessons over and over again to new recruits coming in, and you have to have a database that you can measure it against.
While we watch the tragedy of both police shootings, nearly two decades unfold in Kenosha, I can't help but return to a question that we have asked repeatedly on this show. It's a concept that speaks to the very essence of why American policing seems at times so inexplicably violent and also immune to reform. Why do routine stops and minor encounters lead to death? Why do arrests for minor traffic infractions and nonviolent crimes often end in tragedy? As you recall, American police are among the most violent in the world. An investigation by the Guardian newspaper found police in other countries rarely shoot to kill. For example, in Wales, England, police killed 55 people in 24 years. In the U.S., police killed the same number of people in just 24 days. And even after the death of George Floyd at the hands of police, the killing still hasn't stopped. The Washington Post found the number of police killings are on the same pace as last year, already over 500 killings in 2020. The point is, like the case of Michael Bell and Jacob Blake, how many of these victims are unarmed? How many of these situations could have been de-escalated? And how many of the people who died actually posed a threat? And why do they keep occurring despite the efforts of people like Michael Bell Sr.? It's a question we don't ask enough in this country, and a point that bears repeating each time one of these disturbing deaths occur. Certainly, it is a question we will continue to ask on this show.